Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hola, soy Chad Turnbull.
Y yo soy Elke de la Sota.
Hemos introducido a los Estados Unidos dos catalán vinos, Bogatell y El Raval.
Los vinos son biodinámicos y de muy bien precio. Somos muy orgullosos de estar aquí con Jason. Si estáis interesados en Bogatell o El Raval, haz clic en el link Savorian Wines.
Yo soy Jason Colucci, estoy aquí en Roberta's con Chef Seamus Mullen de Tartulia, un restaurante español. I'm sorry, I thought we were completely doing the show in Spanish. Apparently not. Once again, thank you, Savorian Wines, for your Spanish intro. I wanted to talk about a couple of things. A lot of feedback from the Drew Nieport interview last week. I want to thank Drew again for that interview. He was watching football during the interview, which was good. Everybody said he had a couple of Bloody Marys in him, which kind of mellowed him out a little bit. I did my first pre-recorded interview this week with the producer, Jesse Kiefer. We did the Nathan Myhrvold interview, which was quite an experience. We're going to play that at the latter half of the show. We're gonna do it a three-part series because it was about a 40-minute interview. But today we're going to play the blunder question that I asked him, which basically makes me look retarded. But I'm going to play it because Jesse convinced me to play this question that I had for him. He actually has a T-Rex in his home, and I asked him about it. He explains how he got it. A lot of people in studio today. I'm looking at a lot of... Well, first of all, Chef is here. Chef Seamus Mullen is in studio. If you know his restaurant, Tartulia, I was there this week with Jesse. And first of all, he built most of this restaurant. I mean, sort of design and stuff. I don't know if he was there every day, sort of kind of, you know, hammering things. And knowing the current restaurant industry, I bet he was. And I'm just so happy that he took time out of his busy schedule. He was in the middle of an opening, which in New York City is like just out of control. Laura Wirtz, please say hello.
Hi, Jason. How you doing?
LauraWirtz86list.com. You grace us with your presence this week. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm very glad to be here.
Are you not traveling these days?
No, I just happen to be in Brooklyn this weekend.
And you might hear her voice throughout the show, LauraWirtz86list.com. She's going to do her usual thing, but she might chime in. We're going to talk a little lot of industry stuff today. We have the Eater Awards. I will be attending tomorrow. Thank you to Jesse Kiefer. My vote for favorite restaurant, Tartulia. I believe they're nominated, or Chef. Yeah, please, guys, go on eater.com right now and vote. Chef, are you nominated? I don't know
if I'm nominated this year for an Eater Award, but we definitely, Tartulia is. I think we're up for something like hottest restaurant in New York, something like that.
Please go online right now, eater.com, at Amanda Clute at eater.com, Twitter, go on, vote. I was there the other day. Amazing place. And also we have our first live musician in studio. We'll be playing the breaks. You will not be subjected to my Lady Gaga and Arcade Fire. We will hear the music from Nick Africano. Nick, what's going on? What are you going to play for me today? You know, I'm very specific about my music. Are you going to play Big Texas, the song I wrote?
I'm gonna work that out. I promise. I'll play it in a blues for you. But yeah, I'll play just a little slide music for you, and then a song at the end.
Slide specifically a blues sort of riff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that the music that you usually normally play, or?
Yeah, I play a blues influenced style of music, but also write songs that are more rock and roll, more mellow as well. But today for the instrumental stuff, definitely a little blues.
And I gave an okay on this. You might be tuning for your next song in between an interview I might be doing, so you might hear you in the background. I okayed that. So also, I have a question from a listener. Jennifer Seller asked me, is there a good place in Brooklyn that my father-in-law can order wine for a Thanksgiving feast? We're looking at getting two cases that he would probably order over the phone. Manhattan works too, if they would deliver to our house. I'm not thrilled by any of the stores in Carroll Gardens and Cobble Hill. Jennifer. Well, the first thing that I thought of knowing wine stores is that if you do buy a case, they usually give you a 10 or 20% discount. I live in Park Slope. I know a place called Sip. Also, there's a place called Tinto Fino, since this is a very Spanish forward show today. Jesse, what's her name at Tinto Fino?
Karen at Tinto Fino. It's on First Avenue between 5th and 6th.
And I'm sure she'd be happy. There's nothing that says turkey like a Rioja in terms of as I feel. I'm going to get right into my first guest, Chef Seamus Mullen. I didn't want to do a big, huge, normal, bloated bio because I feel like the proof is here. I met with you and I felt just at home, just sitting with you in the restaurant. It felt so comfortable. Normally sitting with a chef, they're just all over the place and stuff, and you just felt so, the restaurant felt so comfortable, and the feeling of it felt like you guys are in the right stride. Where are you guys at now since opening?
We're getting to hitting our stride.
Okay.
I'm glad that you felt comfortable in the space. That's sort of what we wanted.
And that was a chef's table we were sitting at.
Yeah, you were sitting at the back by the grill in the back in the kitchen. And it takes a long time when you're opening a restaurant to get to a place where you feel comfortable to ease off on the reins a little bit. And we're starting to get there where things are falling into place and settling in. And it's funny, I was talking to Anoop, my chef de cuisine, last night, and he was saying, oh, it just felt like it was really slow. But in reality, it wasn't slow. It's just that we're starting to get to where, you know, things are becoming a little easier, and they're not always challenging, not always difficult. So it's nice. I mean, it's a really good feeling, and it makes it really feel like the place is kind of a home away from home, and a place that's been there for a really long time, which is what we always wanted with Tertulia.
And the building of it, I talked a little bit about it, and you had mentioned that you were a big part of the design aspect of it. Can you talk a little bit about how much you had to do with it?
Sure. I mean, I really wanted the restaurant to be very personal. And I had a clear idea as to how I wanted it to turn out. So I went to Spain with my management team and I also took the designer of the restaurant with me. And he and I ended up working together on pretty much every area of the restaurant. So we chose all the materials and all of the colors. Everything was kind of taken from this reference research trip to Asturias in northern Spain. And it ended up kind of coming together in this beautiful collage that really feels like a restaurant that's been there forever. And one of the nice things about it is the building has been a restaurant since going all the way back to the days of Prohibition. It was the original site of the Redhead, which later became, after it moved uptown, later became the 21 Club. So it's one of the original speakeasies going all the way back to the time of Prohibition, and has been a restaurant since then. Well, there was a short period of time in the 40s when it lived a life as a butcher shop, which is totally appropriate for the space. But other than that, it's always been a restaurant. So I wanted the latest kind of incarnation of the building, and hopefully the last, or at least the last for a very long time, to feel like it was the original, like it had been there for so long and really well worn, and that it would break in. And I think that we have accomplished that. We really got a space that feels like it's going to break in and feel really nice.
Well, so for somebody who spends most of his life in restaurants, it totally felt that way. And I said to Jesse, who when we went there, I felt so comfortable sitting with you and in the restaurant. I had felt like it had been there for a long time. And to talk about where it is, just in jet reference of people, sort of landmarks, you have that what we call the cage is a basketball court there, where a lot of big games happen. It's up 6th Avenue. and what's the exact address?
It's 359 Avenue of the Americas. And it's kind of at the corner of Washington Place, in between Washington Place and West 4th. We try to call it Washington Place and not West 4th, because West 4th has such a negative connotation with all the sex clubs and tattoo shops and stuff like that. But it's in between West 4th and Washington Place on 6th Avenue.
And speaking about butchery, you said that the space had it. Let's talk a little bit about ham. I work in the Italian sort of mm-hmm. format, and prosciutto di Parma is sort of prosciutto di San Daniele and all that stuff. Iberico ham. I mean, what's going on with that now? It's obviously the best stuff out there. Mm-hmm. But is there differing opinions on where the best stuff is coming from? Or?
Yeah. Well, Iberico is a term that's used to refer to the breed of pig. Okay. Which is a relatively small pig from southern Spain that's been in Spain since the time of the Phoenicians. And the ham that we've come to know as jamón ibérico de bellota, which means Iberico ham fed on acorns, has been produced in Spain for hundreds and hundreds of years, dating way back before the time of refrigeration when we had to use salt to preserve food. And the Ibérico ham happens to, the Ibérico pig happens to respond really well to salting. And there are only a few producers in Spain that really do it properly, where the pigs are raised in open areas. It's called the dehesa, which is an acorn forest where the pigs basically in the summer they don't eat anything, and then as the fall comes on and the acorns come into season and they drop from the trees, the pigs gorge on them, and then they live off of the acorns for that they've eaten for the rest of the year. So they have this really unique metabolism where they can go long periods of months without eating, and then they can gorge and live off of their fat reserves. And what that ends up producing is a meat that's very well marbled and has a tremendous amount of fat. And if it's handled well and aged properly, you end up with this exquisite ham, which is called jamón ibérico de bellota. It obviously has a lot of value and marketing value, the term, particularly in Spain, and now with a greater understanding of Spanish products outside of Spain. It's a really important product and term to use, but unfortunately there aren't a whole lot of regulations about what can be called and what can't be called jamón ibérico, and it ends up that a lot of producers call their ham jamón ibérico de bellota, even if they're only 50% ibérico pigs, a heritage breed pig, and even if they aren't free range, and even if they aren't fed on acorns. So you end up with this huge delta between what two products called the same thing that are labeled the same way, and they can be completely different. One is exquisite, and the other one is basically factory or raised meat. So up until now, there haven't been too many producers that have had the resources to produce a facility in Spain that would be up to USDA standards. And now there's one of the best producers in Spain. And they've just, as of 2 weeks ago, gotten USDA approval to export to the U.S. So we started getting their ham 2 weeks ago, and it's incredible.
I'm speaking now with Chef Seamus Mullen, chef of Tortuglia. We're going to take a break now, and we're going to come back. I want to talk a little bit about his history coming up in New York City and Spanish food and where it's come and where it's going. Jason Colucci, The Morning After. We're back. I'm talking to Seamus Mullen. Seamus, chef, because I don't know if you notice when I do a lot of interviews, there's some people that work and I call them chef and stuff. I work with a lot of big chefs, and I really say that in the chef with the highest respect, because after spending some time with you briefly, I feel that you are sort of authority on Spanish food now. Can you talk a little bit about coming to New York and being in Spain and your career and how it's led to this point?
Yeah, I mean, I have a long relationship with Spain. I've been going there for 20 years, and I first went there for my senior year in high school and fell in love with the language and the culture and the food. And since then, I've gone back over the years for different periods of time, and I cooked there for a while and lived there. And when I moved back to New York City, I felt like there was a real dearth of Spanish food in New York.
What year was that?
That was in 2005.
Okay.
Yeah. And so in 2006, I opened with my former partner. I opened a restaurant called Boqueria, which
we all know,
which ended up being actually the sort of the common ground that brought a lot of the people in this room together. Nick, I got to know, and Jesse and Aaron, obviously at Boqueria, and a lot of wonderful things came out of it. And I think we really helped bring Spanish food to New York. we certainly raise the bar of Spanish food in New York. And it's great. It's a very open playing field in a lot of ways. There's a lot of, obviously, a ton of Italian and French restaurants in New York, and there are very few Spanish restaurants. And there's a few that are really extraordinary, and the folks at Chiquito, Alex and Ed, are doing an incredible job. They do wonderful food, really wonderful people. But there really aren't that many people that are cooking Spanish food in New York. So it's been a great challenge, and it's also been a great, you know, great thing to work on here.
Do you think it's just because of, in terms of why it's not that way, just because of, there was a lot of, you know, Italian people, French people here cooking, and that was sort of the thing? Or do you think that, to me, growing up, Spanish food was just a big thing of paella, and, you know, there was a lot of different ingredients in it, and it came out in a La Crusade pot, and everybody shared it. I mean, but now it's sort of taken on a whole nother.
And there's nothing, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I think a lot of it goes back to the fact that you have a huge Italian American population here, and while there isn't really a huge French American population here, France has always been the default place that we go to when we think of high cuisine. Just having the Italian community, whether it's in New York or even in Pittsburgh or in Cleveland or in, you know, wherever you are, Philadelphia, they're large, predominant Italian neighborhoods, and the Italians have always been very good about preserving their culinary history and bringing it with them. The Spaniards tend to be much more introverted. It's an introverted culture that really, they have a lot of wonderful things, but because they lived under such an oppressive regime for so many years, there was kind of like this suppressed creativity, which obviously after Franco died in 1975, there's just this incredible explosion, and we're still seeing it. I mean, people like Ferran Adrià they're part of the, he is a huge part of this creative explosion in Spain. And I think because of that, Spain just didn't have the same kind of distribution network that other cuisines have had in the U.S., and so there was a very limited understanding of what Spanish cuisine is. But with Ferran, people they suddenly started looking at Spain as a place to go for food, and they got there with the expectation of seeing fireworks and seeing just this tremendous intergalactic food that Ferran does, and they ended up finding that not only is there that, but there's this an incredible history of and tradition of traditional food, of really wonderful product-based cooking.
And the restaurant you're referencing is El Bulli?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, and is Jose Andreas have any? Is he a part of the sort of? Would you consider him somebody who is?
I think that he's been an incredible proponent of Spanish food in the United States, and he's been in a lot of ways. He's really helped Ferran extend his sort of his reach within.
He's almost like an ambassador.
Yeah, he's very much like an ambassador of Ferran. But then, of course, Jose Andres is also he's grown into being, you know, one of the foremost authorities on Spanish cuisine anywhere, and certainly in the United States.
Now let's get back into New York City. And currently, do you and family and restaurants? Everyone that works at this restaurant, are you sous chefs? I'm assuming these are guys that came up with you and work with you.
Mm-hmm.
And just meeting you the other day, I could just tell by the how calm you were at the table that you knew that the kitchen was under control. The guys that are in there, are these people that have been working with you for a long time?
Yeah, a lot of them have been with me for a long time. And I have, I'm very lucky to have wonderful people that work in the kitchen with me and in the front of the house as well. We have a really, we have a very cohesive and supportive staff. And it very much feels like a family. And I wouldn't be able to do this if I didn't. I mean, I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease, and I simply can't work 16 hours a day, 6-7 days a week any longer. So if I didn't have people that, one, supported me and understood my limitations, but at the same time shared my vision for the restaurant and for hospitality, I wouldn't be able to do it. So I'm very lucky to have the group of people that I have that I work with.
Well, Chef, I just want to say I'm very lucky to have you in the studio. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Sure.
I hope you hang out for the rest of the show. You're more than welcome. Nick, can you take us out? This show's come a long way. We're in episode 9. We're going to celebrate our 10th anniversary, 10 weeks of The Morning After. We're going to go into 86ls.com. Laura Wirtz gracing us with her presence in studio. Whoa, Laura Wirtz, 86ls.com. Laura Wirtz, hot job of the week. Go ahead.
All right, here I am in studio. It's becoming the holiday season. So what that means is a lot of holiday parties, a lot of special events. And so this week's Hot Job of the Week is coming from the supporting cast. They're a staffing agency for catering and hotel events. And right now they're looking for banquet servers and bartenders. They say they're looking for somebody that has at least 2 years of experience, and they're looking for people that have that are TIPS certified. And what that means is that they've taken a class that prepares them for how to deal with people who, to prevent drunk driving, intoxication, and underage drinking. So they're really looking for some serious, responsible people.
Laura Wirtz, I'm TIPS certified.
Oh, you are?
Yes, when I opened the Excel Club at Citi Field, I had to take that class for being a 1099 for Aramark.
Okay, yeah, it seems like it's for, you know, larger places. Like, yes. Hotels and large catering firms.
It's a liability thing, and it's something you can do in 2 hours. We could. I'm getting. What's going on in that booth? The booth's very active today. We have somebody online. I think
We have Steve online.
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
Oh wow, that's awesome! Because I'm drinking his cider right now, and I was, I wanted to talk a little bit more about TIPS and Aramark because that's such an exciting thing to talk about. Laura.
Yes.
What's up? What's your experiences right now in studio? What's going on? Do you notice anything different? Is it different than being on the phone or what?
Well, it definitely is. Like, you know, I get a feel for the whole vibe of the show. I always listen whenever I'm not in studio, but, you know, it's nice to get to, meet some of these people.
Do you listen to the show or you listen to your own parts?
I've confessed to not having listened to all of the shows, but I like to know what's going on.
Okay.
Sometimes I'm just not in a good spot. I can't get in there and listen to the whole show.
I enjoy honesty. We're going to go. We have Steve Woods on the line, proprietor, cider maker for Farnham Hill. We're drinking his cider right now. Steve.
Hey.
What's up, buddy?
Gosh, I don't know, man.
Are you, where are you right now?
I'm at my orchard.
Are you inside, or are you actually walking around?
Loading dock. Does the loading dock work for you? I'm on the loading dock looking. Not walking. I'm not out. I'm not out with my dog and my stick.
No,
I'm at the place.
No, this is radio. We have to paint a picture for the audience, you know.
No, there you have it. Well, no, I'm outside a barn looking down at a bunch of orchards.
Right now we're drinking Dooryard Cider. Can you talk a little bit? We're drinking Dooryard Cider. This is one of your Can you talk a little bit? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a relatively new notion for us, or rather an old notion, but we finally did it. I don't know what Dooryard you're drinking, and you can spin the bottle around and tell me by looking at the number on the back, but the
1125.
The idea
1125.
Yeah, very good.
Purchase that, at Whole Foods.
You know, let me tell you about. I'll tell you about Dooryard. The idea is that we have, without really intending to do so, we've sort of created some brands. Meaning, we have semi dry and extra dry and farmhouse and all of the stuff that we've been making for years. Each of them has a flavor and aroma profile or something, meaning to say there are expectations based around those things. And we're constantly trying to improve them, and they're not consistent, perfectly consistent or anything. But a huge departure from one of them would be a little weird under the same label. And meanwhile, you know, we have a lot of fruit of different sorts here. We make a lot of, we ferment a lot of different things, and we always have a bunch of cider that. It's not that we don't quite know what to do with. We didn't, but used to. But we sort of sell it locally. We don't know. It doesn't really fit into our, you know, one or another of our regular labels. And we wouldn't have dared do this years ago. But now, or even maybe 4 years ago. But we decided to just have a sort of. We got a label approved from the feds that is a movable feast. It allows us to put small batches of one thing or another together and move them out to the broad market. So sometimes, I mean, sometimes a small batch is 1,000 gallons, and sometimes it's a 50 gallons. But the point is telling you, say, I mean, if you told me you really liked it, you really didn't like semi-dry, I'd say, yeah, well, you know, whatever. But you tell me you really like or don't like Dooryard, it has no meaning, because the next Dooryard might be very, very different from the one you're drinking now. So it's just a way of getting, you know, a bunch of different ciders out there.
We like it.
That's the idea.
As everyone's drinking in the studio, everyone's nodding their head that we definitely like this vintage, the 1125 vintage that could be purchased at the Whole Foods on the corner of Houston and Bowery, which we purchased. Can you define the orchardist? Can you define that term? Because does that play into sort of fermenting apples, or is that just basically managing an orchard?
Oh, man. No, it's the whole deal. Okay. Now, I've been growing apples. I mean, this orchard's been here for quite a long time. It's changed its shape a lot, but I've been working at the orchard since 1965, and you know, this view extends outward to wine with me as well. I think the best ciders and the best wines, for that matter, are made in the orchard or made in the vineyard, and that the cider maker or the vineyard's whatever winemaker's job is not to screw up the good stuff he's got if he's got good stuff. We have our orchards are absolutely central to our ciders are what they are, whether you like them or not. They are what they are because of the orchards, because of the actual specific place. You know, the dirt, the aspect of the land,
the terroir, if you will,
the climate. The whole deal. Terroir is real. I mean, there are a lot of other things out there, but terroir is real, and it's real with orchards as well. And the trick in the orchard is to not just to grow an apple, but to discover what varieties of the thousands of varieties out there, what small handful of varieties that your actual piece of ground wants to grow, or what things want to grow there, the things that can be grown to a really high standard. I mean, the cider apples that go into our ciders, you know, they're a result of, well, I mean, we didn't used to grow cider apples, but when we had or decided to change what we did up here in the way of what we grew, which is, you know, a thing that's too elaborate to elaborate, having to do with, you know, market forces, whatever, 20 or 25 years ago, we selected those cider varieties from hundreds, the few cider varieties we grew from hundreds of stuff, hundreds of varieties that we'd done grafting trials on for, you know, decades. So it wasn't just randomly saying, well, let's grow some cider apples now. It's like sort of saying, well, let's grow some Cabernet Sauvignon here in Florida. You know, I mean, it doesn't really work. You've got to know your ground and what it'll grow.
When you're talking about terroir, we're talking about Lebanon, New Hampshire. That's the area where everything takes place. And since we're doing, we have a sort of a Spanish theme here, we'll say, what is the Tempranillo of the cider now? What are some of the varietals that come up in terms of apples? Laura Wirtz would love to think it's Crispin because she loves cooking with that apple. But what are some of the apples that we are talking about?
Well, Crispin just ain't going to work for us. Crispin's a wonderful variety, but not a wonderful variety.
But it's good for apple tart.
It's a good baking
view.
Apple.
I mean, yeah, Crispin is Mutsu, and it's a wonderful apple. But I have fermented it. I wouldn't do it again. and there is no Tempranillo. What there are a number of varieties, bittersweet varieties, which are characterized by very high tannins and usually very low acidity, which are essential components to our many ciders around the world. With names like Dabinet and Medidor, Somerset Red Streak, Yarlington Mill. I was referring to one earlier. I have this sort of every variety actually lacks something, and what I think is that this may be a little bit more true of apples than it is of grapes, but I think it's actually true of grapes as well. That the best varieties actually don't really particularly, with the possible extent of the Pinot Noir and the you know in Burgundy or whatever, don't really want to go by themselves. They have enormous characteristics that they bring to the fermentation and blending, whatever. But bittersweets are not lack acidity. But and they have there are a lot of. I mean, again, it's hard to talk in a generic way about these things. But you know, the other ones are acidic apples that we use are things like Wixen and Esopus Spitzenberg and Ashmead's Kernel. Are sort of more sort of fruit bomb apples or things like Golden Russet. But most of the ciders, the finished ciders that we put out, you know, there might be a dozen varieties in one of them.
Well,
it's not random, but it's not, you know, they like to be with their friends in a tank or a barrel.
Well, Steve, I know how busy you are. I want to thank you for your time today. If anyone wants to go on the website, Farnham Hill, we're drinking the cider right now. Of course, this is from batch to batch. We're drinking 1125, which I definitely vouch for, Farnham Hill Dooryard Cider. Steve, thanks again. We'll check in with you a few weeks, few months.
Yeah, very good. You know where to find me. Thanks very much for calling.
Anytime. We're going to take a break now. We're going to come back. I'm going to play the Nathan Myhrvold Modernist Cuisine interview. Morning again. Wow, I never knew so much the apple had so many qualities. I want to go into the interview I did this week. It was a pre-interview I talked a little bit about in the beginning of the show, but this is one of the first pre-recorded interviews I had done. Now, let me preface this interview by saying this was via Gmail, via a phone call via Gmail, and recorded through Rock Band. GarageBand. and I was running around, and I probably queued it up wrong here, but I think I have it queued up properly. This is Nathan Myhrvold schooling me and basically telling me that dinosaurs and humans didn't exist at the same time. And here we go. Let me queue it up.
This is a weird question, but I've heard this. Do you have a T-Rex in your living room or something? A Tyrannosaurus?
I do.
You do? A full size?
I do. I can see it from where I'm sitting right now.
That is amazing. Now, is that your discovery? Was that your one of your discoveries?
No, the funny thing is I bought a cast of a T-Rex for my living room because I've always loved dinosaurs. Yeah. Every little kid loves dinosaurs. I just never grew out of it. Then I started doing a lot of scientific research on dinosaurs, so I decided I wanted one at home, so I bought a cast of a specimen. Well, I also, in parallel with that, I've been working on a dinosaur expedition. We went out every year for 7 years to an area in Montana, and I was actually there when we discovered a T-Rex. So I found one, but I already had one.
That's a rule. You know, you can't.
This is like a hunter having somebody else's deer head up in his room, but you know, I don't really have room for two T-Rexes in my living room. So
well, Nathan, you
I'm
know,
just stick with the one I've got.
You know the unwritten rule. You're not supposed to own one more than one T-Rex. We all know that. We grew up with that rule. Parents taught it to us. But that's funny, man. I heard that, and I so wanted to ask you because it was kind of going around in different interviews. That's amazing. Do they find were sort of cavemen and stuff? Were they dining on dinosaur meat? I know that's a weird question, but is that like is
well, ancient humans yeah. and dinosaurs were completely separated in time. Back in the age of the dinosaurs, our relative mammals were tiny. They were mostly little rat-like creatures. The biggest mammal that that lived during the time of the dinosaurs was about the size of a big cat.
Yeah.
There were no cavemen. There weren't even any monkeys. There were a bunch of very small primitive mammals.
Now, that was about... Thank you. Well, I'm a child of cinema and a product of a social anxiety. I was in the middle of a minute 30 when I asked that question, and I was trying to get into just basically what this interview goes, which was, you know, what his thoughts of dinosaur meat might have tasted like through his studies. But you know, luckily I had Jesse right next to me laughing at me while I was doing this, so the stress even went higher. I'll play the end of it. Here we go.
So then the dinosaurs all died 65 million years ago. Today we think that was probably because of the impact of an asteroid that hit the Earth, changed the entire environment, drove dinosaurs extinct. Well, that's when mammals finally got their day in the sun. Mammals had been around the whole time there were dinosaurs, but dinosaurs dominated everything, so the mammals just couldn't catch a break. Well, this extinction was the break they needed. Mammals grew. So humans, ancient humans, depending on which ancient human you're thinking of, only go back a couple million years. And when people think of cavemen, it's even less than that. You know, hundreds of thousands of years would be most of the species that people think of as cavemen. So they could not have possibly dined on dinosaurs.
I'm sorry. My reference point was the movie Cavemen, starring Ringo Starr, which came out in like '85. I don't know if you've seen it. It's kind of a funny movie.
Yes. Well, as I can see, really, you're an academic.
But Doctor,
Now, you know, I've wondered quite a bit as to what dinosaurs taste like.
Yeah.
That's where I was going.
I mean, I guess that's what I was getting at, and everyone is laughing at me right now. What sort of the flavor profile?
The closest living relatives to dinosaurs are birds. And the birds that have a lifestyle most similar to dinosaurs are probably the ratites. That's ostrich, emu. Ostrich is probably as close as you're going to get to eating dinosaur. And it's great. Ostrich is a great meat. You know, it's a lean red meat. Looks much more like a lean beef, like a flank steak, than it does like what you'd think of as a bird.
Hmm.
And so that's probably a, if you want to approach what a dinosaur was like, that's probably the best current example.
Well, that is the lead-in for the three-part series with Nathan Myhrvold, author of Modernist Cuisine. And that was at the tail end of stuff when I was just kind of like throwing questions out there. And we'll do it at three parts. I asked him a lot about his history with food. He was the chief technologist at Microsoft for a bunch of years and was really into food. He cooked his mom Thanksgiving, the family Thanksgiving dinner at the age of 9. And basically, he's, essentially a genius. I mean, it was funny talking to him on the phone and then having that sort of speech told to me, which was kind of funny. It was almost associated. I hate sports analogies because I'm not a big sports fan. When you sort of, you're running the opposite way and you're running into your end zone and scoring a touchdown and, or something where, everyone's yelling at you and saying, no, don't say that. But it was funny. And I wanted to play it. Jesse sort of convinced me. Jesse, can you, talk a little bit, 2 seconds about being there?
It was fantastic. And in the future, I'd like to refer to this as the, as Jason's Land of the Lost moment.
Land of the Lost. Yes. We love that show. Not the remake with Will Ferrell. We want to forget about that. But we want to talk about Choco, which was Mark McGrath from Sugar Ray. He played Choco in that great series that we all love. You can actually catch it on YouTube. But I have somebody on the line right now. This is a gentleman from one of Jesse's favorite restaurants. And I wanted to talk about this because I'd like to get out of the realm of New York City a little bubble here. We're going to go all the way to Scottsdale, Arizona, to a Giuseppe restaurant. Pasquale, are you there?
Yes, sir. I am here. Afternoon. How are you?
Ciao, Pasquale. How is it going? What's going on in Arizona right now? Are you in the restaurant or what?
No, actually, I'm not in the late on. I was stopped over Sunday. My gang does a good job.
Where are you? Are you in some basement or something? Take a walk somewhere outside of the space you're at right now, because your connection's coming in really, really tough right
really?
Now.
Really? Well, yeah. I was in the car here. I'm going
to
want to make any noise.
Oh, hey, well, step out of the car and, you know, step outside. It's all good.
Well, hey, it's beautiful and sunny over here, so that's okay. I can do that. I can
perfect. Stay right there. Stop right there. Thank you very much. I hate to be so abrupt, but these connections can kind of change the entire interview. Jessie loves this restaurant. She is our childhood restaurant. It's a place, a familiar place for everyone that kind of grew up there. And I love these places. I'm an Italian American, and you know, I have a special place in my heart. That spot is called Lee's Tavern. But can you talk a little about the restaurant and the menu?
Sure. I have a little restaurant. I seat about 45 people, and it's what would say like a hole in the wall, southern kind of dishes, Neapolitan, lots of tomato sauce, pasta, eggplant, and we try to make everybody happy. I know Jesse, the whole family, oh Jesus, we know each other over 20-some years.
Well, when you say, you know, I want to get into this because, you know, you're talking about dishes. We're talking about, you know, the dishes that, you know, the Mario Batali's of the world wanted us to forget about, which is just a classic sort of Americanized right. Chicken Parmesan. I mean, it's essentially, you know, breaded chicken, you know, put in a fry later or fried, you know, in a shallow pan or something. That's something that you offer right. at your restaurant, which is a great dish. Is that what are some of the more popular dishes that you sell?
Well, we do have, like I was saying before, we do have chicken, we have veal, we have eggplant, we have, we sell just about everything that we have. We try to make sometimes, you know, specials of the day, and basically it's always in a, like we have a great thing. We have the biggest, best little written meatballs in town. So we sell quite a few of those. Everything I have on the menu I sell.
So. No, yeah. All right, so let me ask you this question, because this is something yeah. as an American, as Italian, I want to set the standard straight. I had somebody here last week. Is it do you have calamari on the menu?
We have
squid.
Friday we'll do a cioppino, which is a pasta with seafood, and we have the calamari, we have clams, yes.
So in Arizona they're calling it calamari, they're not calling it calamari. You know that statement that basically second generations of Americans call calamari to make themselves feel like they still speak the language?
Well, some people, they say, you know, they use that kind of stuff to go fishing, but I eat because I love it.
Yeah, well, they use it as chum, right? Yeah.
yes.
So thank you for your time. I these places are all over the country, and you've been in business for a long time, and there's a lot of New Yorkers that live in Arizona specifically.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you sort of know what is that sort of migration? What that sort of to Arizona? What's that all about?
Well, you know, when you come from the East, Boston area, New York, New Jersey, they find my place, which is a little, like I would say before, a little hole in the wall. They feel like they're back home. You know, we keep that tradition, still white, red checkers, tablecloths. I, as you notice, I don't speak that good English, even though I've been in almost 40 years in the country. So they feel, you know, the people from back east, they feel at home here with me.
Well, don't worry. Nathan Myhrvold feels the same way about me. Sorry, that wasn't good.
Well, with a name like yours, you know, yes.
Well, I will, on that note, I will take that advice into consideration. Thank you for your time. We'll talk soon.
I thank you very much. To give the chance to talk to you. If there's any other question you want to talk about, let me know. I know you have very little time, but I thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk to the people back home.
Ciao, grazie, grazie.
Grazie, signore. You have a wonderful Domenica.
Thank you. Before our in-house musician here goes and plays and leads the show out, I wanted you to sort of talk about, you know, plug some gigs that you have coming up, and that would be great.
Nick? Yeah, absolutely. This is good timing. I have my first gig at the Mercury Lounge next Saturday, the 19th at 7 p.m. It's cool for me. It was sort of a goal this year to get on that stage and perform there, doing my own show. And I've played there and with other bands, and this time my band will be the opening band, and then good friends of mine follow.
Awesome. Thank you, Nick Africano, for being here today. I appreciate the time. I want to thank all my guests. This is The Morning After, Episode 9. We're going to lead ourselves out here today. We'll see you next week. We'll be covering the Eater Awards this week. Nathan Myhrvold is in the city. I'm going to try and catch up with him. Once again, The Morning After.
Walk these streets till I get somewhere. Standing still won't get me anywhere. These nights are deserts. These days are circles. Sometimes we all need a little help. Sometimes we all start to drag our heels. Sometimes we don't remember how to feel. Lonely hearts don't beat anymore. Nothing on your journey, and I took too much. Now I gave it all up. God knows that when I fall, at least I got this blood on my skin. At least I got this moment I'm in. These nights are deserts. These days are circles. Sometimes we all need a little help. Sometimes we all start to drag our heels. Sometimes we don't remember how to feel. Lonely hearts don't feel. We're not alive alone, alone alive. We all need a little help sometimes. We all need a little love to survive. We all need a little love to survive. These nights are deserts. These days are circles. Sometimes we all need a little help. Sometimes we all start to drag our heels. Sometimes we don't remember how to feel.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.